Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is a sunny, sunny Thursday, except not exactly that warm, unfortunately. I'd like to welcome you all to The Angry Young Man. Firstly, before we do get into the mix of things, just like to remind you all that everything that is said today by myself and my guest is not necessarily representative of the views of WRCT or its members and are strictly those of myself and my guest, which let's get right into it with introducing my wonderful guest, a friend of mine. It's going to be Ilyas Khan. How you doing?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I don't know. It's middle of the second semester, so what more can you say?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's got that vibe to it, especially once, you know, it's supposed to be nice and warm now and you're getting February temperatures back.
Oh boy. Yep. Yeah. I totally feel it. It was like 70 degrees last week and I was outside tanning and then
it was beautiful.
Horrible.
Well, so, you know, for those of you just tuning in, Ilyas, you are a member of the Sunrise Movement in Pittsburgh.
Yes,
Can you tell us a little bit about Sunrise?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm actually the hub coordinator of our local Sunrise Movement hub. And what Sunrise Movement essentially is and does is it's a youth-oriented climate justice movement, right? So it's not just an organization, but really it's a concept of how to make change around climate change and climate justice on a local level. And my job, really, with Sunrise Movement is just to make sure that we are engaging with our community and we are, you know, moving apace in terms of making actual direct climate policy change. So that's kind of my position, and you know, over the past 2 years I've been in the position, you know, it's been really wonderful to get to know and really work with Allegheny County communities on issues of climate justice.
So what are some ways that you've kind of practically worked with our communities in Allegheny County and worked to kind of push for change?
Absolutely. So there's been some really wonderful things happening at the county level, particularly recently, but also in the past. A few years ago, we were part of the coalition that managed to pass a ban on fracking in public parks, which apparently you could do until a few years ago. And there were huge risks, kind of, you know, if you've grown up in Southwest PA, you know just how dangerous a lot of the fracked gas wells can be, especially for children, right? So to have that, you know, just out in the open where children are playing was a huge risk to public safety. And we managed to put a stop to any future construction of those fracked gas wells. And just recently, we were part of the major push to have the new administration draft a climate action plan, really a comprehensive plan to address more than just climate, but also things like housing inequity, flood and emergency services, healthcare, all kinds of stuff, really, that are integral to creating a sustainable Allegheny County in the years to come.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you who have been listening to the show for the past couple weeks, you'll know that we spoke a little bit to this issue of, you know, kind of localized climate-related or environmental policy-related actions taken, particularly by determining what the particular needs and wants or sacrifices that a community wants to make, depending on their situation. And that's, you know, something that you've kind of very practically dealt with hands-on. And something I did want to kind of drill into a little bit, just because, you know, no pun intended on the fracking, but, you know, the issue of housing in Allegheny County and Pittsburgh, that's something that I haven't had the opportunity to kind of talk about here and would love to kind of address with you, particularly because there are a couple things at play right now. You know, firstly, with the new administration, like you'd mentioned, there's a policy goal in the area that the Innamorato administration has, particularly something that she had campaigned on, which I find to be particularly concerning, was the housing reassessment that she and her administration is embarking on currently, which many people pointed to during that election season as something which would disproportionately hurt large swaths of the Pittsburgh and Allegheny County communities that would have the assessment of their property put at a higher level, pushing them to pay more in property tax. Particularly something that I would say has the opportunity to, especially if this is something that is being pressed on to people who rent out. You have when someone's renting out to a college student or someone who's in lower income bracket, when they have their property taxes raised, that's something that's going to get passed along in cost in rent. And that's something, you know, obviously we want to avoid that, especially for people who are in less of a position to provide capital upfront for their renting purposes. And to increase that is to push a higher detriment upon them. And that's something that, you know, one thing I was concerned about. And the second thing that I'm not too sure about, if that's something that's being pursued by the administration, but there was a mention during the campaign of a tenant's bill of rights, which involved within it, to my understanding, the basis for price controls on rent, which I've spoken about before on the show, particularly the first time around, but also spoke about it a little bit in length on my talk on rent controls in Argentina, kind of talking about the issues that are inherent to price controls and what that ends up passing on to in cost to renters. So I'm curious to get some reflections from you in regards to, you know, someone who's had the opportunity to work on drafting housing-related policy to suggest to the administration in Allegheny County.
Absolutely. So most of the policy that I've engaged with is less directly housing, but it is related through questions of sustainability as well as affordability and equity as a whole, you know. And I think you bring up a great point that, you know, when we have questions of tax reassessment and redistribution, oftentimes this can end up heavily affecting marginalized communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, but also, you know, more urban communities that depend more heavily on renting. But I think, you know, you brought up the idea of a tenant's bill of rights. You know, on the one hand, right, your fear about the potential for how tenants can be disproportionately impacted by these reassessments is very much valid and justified, and I share it, as a matter of fact. But I think to have a tenant's bill of rights isn't necessarily, you know, pushing us towards an Argentinian model per se, but I think it does open up a lot of avenues for tenants to actually have a greater degree of decision-making power in their own rental situations. And that, as well as the insured protections for those tenants, which are, you know, a natural product of that Bill of Rights, would sort of hopefully, you know, assuming I haven't quite seen a draft of that bill.
Yeah.
But you know, assuming the All In for Allegheny County survey, which I don't know if you were aware of.
Yes, I haven't had the opportunity to kind of look through it, but I was aware that that was circulating at the moment. Yeah.
Right. So there are some questions about housing, as I recall. It was a very long survey. Sarah, next time you do that, please give us a heads up about how long it's going to be. I think to have a Bill of Rights might help alleviate some of that potential stress, because it would put renters in greater control of that whole dynamic, and allow for more negotiation between tenants and their landlords.
Well, I too am not very familiar with a lot of the things that were proposed in it. Just one thing that stood out to me during that process was the prospect of potential rent control in Allegheny County. And that, you know, the reason I bring up Argentina is because nationally in 2020 there was an ordinance passed for the institution of rent controls in Argentina. And, you know, rent controls are one primary thing, but even looking at other potential regulation regarding the relationship between tenant and landlord, when you impose, firstly, rent controls on a landlord, you know, this is your ceiling for charging rent. At a certain point, it becomes more profitable for these landlords to sell the properties than to further provide housing as an opportunity, which contracts the supply of available rental housing. And that's a primary concern there, but also at the same time, what you saw in Argentina was a lot of the times landlords would forego very expensive repair or maintenance on the property just because of the other absorbed cost that would come by having a much higher overhead compared to now a restricted rent, which in many cases, hopefully this would not be the case in Allegheny County, but specifically in a high inflation economy, is not very adaptable to the needs of suppliers in that case. So that's kind of one thing there, but also just in terms of other kind of like more abstract non-economic regulation, you know, just the attractiveness of providing housing and to try to do so in a competitive market for housing, so as to try to attract a renter to say, this is the place that I would want to live over this other place, because they're offering potentially better amenities, lower rent. My concern is that in attempting to regulate that market, we might end up seeing a more rigid structure, which doesn't allow for landlords to kind of compete against each other and ultimately allow the consumers, in this case the renters, to be able to make better choices with a better selection of available renting opportunities. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, Argentina's history with rental control doesn't start in 2020. It actually starts in the 1920s with the first rental control policies that were instituted there. And, you know, even in the 1920s, they were struggling with it. But, you know, it was far more sustainable because of Argentina's much smaller population, right? You didn't have, Buenos Aires was not like a city of 20 million like
yeah.
It is now, you know. And similarly, you know, rental control policies existed across, you know, many countries at that period of time, because it simply made more sense, you know, in terms of like both the labor market and also the housing market. I think here, you know, I'm not a big fan of landlords personally. Mm-hmm. I believe very firmly in the democratization of rental, meaning that tenants should actually have unions, which would then own apartment complexes and help regulate rent, you know, such that the needs of the tenants are provided for by virtue of it being a tenant owned space. But because we're working with a system in which we have landlords, I think, you know, this question of whether or not, I mean, right now, what we are seeing in this housing market is very large companies will essentially become landlords, right? And they have no incentive to compete with other companies because they're not even from here, right? A lot of these groups, like, they have no real stakes in Pittsburgh, right? A lot of the housing developers have no real stake in Pittsburgh. A lot of the apartment owners have no real stake in Pittsburgh. It's just about the production of capital, which, you know, it's not really serving the consumers as much as I would like. And I think imposing, if not rental control, but some way of ensuring that the people who are owning these properties, who are renting these properties, have a vested stake in the community, right? Some sort of imposition like that, I think, should be a minimum, right? Because if you don't have a stake in the community, if you don't see the Pittsburgh community as something that you are a part of and therefore should engage with and provide for, then I really don't think you should be a landlord, because you're only going to put your own tenants and yourself at a disadvantage, because your turnover rate will probably be incredibly high if you're not interested in and invested in the community you're a part of and creating.
Well, firstly, you know, I definitely agree on the premise of trying to encourage community. And, you know, I very firmly believe that you're always going to have a better relationship with, you know, your local mom and pop than you are with, you know, your local Target. But what I will say at the same time is two things. Firstly, you know, any supplier of any good is ultimately going to be beholden to the people who consume from them. And I would say in the case of, you know, like, let's take some large company that's decided to grab some skin in the game in the Pittsburgh rental market. They want to be as attractive as possible to the Pittsburgh rental community in order to attract people to rent from their properties. And that puts them up against other people in this market. And that may be other large actors, maybe two or three, and then a combined medley of, you know, individual rent landlords who have maybe one to three or four properties that they rent. These people, I mean, while you all have larger competitors in there, to my understanding, Pittsburgh is not under. I know Walnut Capital is a very large renter in Pittsburgh, a large landlord in Pittsburgh, but is one of many actors in the Pittsburgh rental market. And what I think is so great about, you know, there's, and something I want to get back to was the conceptualization of kind of union-owned housing communities that you'd brought up. And I kind of want to hear a little bit more about that in a second. But what I think is interesting is, you know, when you have in a ideally free market, when the renters are looking at their options, their ability to allocate their capital to wherever they see is the most worthy of doing so allows them to influence the action of these actors that are trying to provide housing in this case. You know, you want to stick it to these people that are trying to jack your rent up 25% in this one neighborhood. You know, you say, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, my good friend Joe in Shadyside is offering me a better going rate. While it may be another 10-minute commute, that the marginal utility that I gain from choosing this over what you're giving me is going to be higher, so I'm going to go that way. And then Walnut Capital could be like, well, no, we want you to stay here. Might prevent them from going through with that. You know, you have across the board things like inflation or economic conditions, which will cause rents across the board to raise, and there's nothing you could really do about that. And in the case in which you institute rent controls, you end up having the negative economic shock of prices not adjusting on all ends, and you end up disadvantaging one player in the equation over the other, and that's when you start to have issues.
Well, you know, what I would say to that is that, like, the players are already, you know, they've had their legs cut at the ankle, right, in a lot of these cases. And I think it's, I mean, we're sitting here at Carnegie Mellon. We're coming to this from an incredibly privileged perspective, right? Because we can afford to say, well, I've got a buddy Joe who can provide me a better going rate. But, you know, if you're a black or brown tenant in the city of Pittsburgh, you know, oftentimes your choice is between a rock and a hard place. I mean, and this is how gentrification has occurred across the city, where huge swaths of communities like East Liberty, like The Hill, like others, Highland Park and more, where and Oakland is probably the most egregious example, right, in the city, where the original population has been slowly displaced and replaced because of these kind of rental turnover. And where have they been forced to go? They've either been forced to leave the city or they've been forced to move to the suburbs. And this is why Pittsburgh is one of the worst cities in the country for black Americans to live in. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen those statistics.
I have seen that, yes.
And, you know, that's atrocious, right? Like, I think you and I are both on the same page that, like, a city should be a livable place for everyone, regardless of who you are and what your economic standing may be. You know, there should at least be, you know, the option for you to be safe and comfortable in your own community, right? And so I think, like, when we're talking about the issue of, you know, competition and things like that in the local renters market, we have to have a measure of sensitivity to that reality for those disadvantaged tenants, because, like, you know, if you're a student in Oakland, still many students in Oakland are disadvantaged. I've spoken to so many students at Pitt who are, you know, tenants for Walnut Capital, who are like, I can't really find anywhere else, mm-hmm. you know, because if you're trying to be a student in Pittsburgh, living in Oakland is one of your best options.
Yeah.
Public transit, access to food and water, like, you know, there's so much that you're dependent on here
yeah.
in Oakland. So I think, you know, there's more factors than just, like, the market itself in Pittsburgh that
yeah.
we have to be cognizant of.
Well, and I'd extend it to say, and I think this might be an area where we have some agreement, that current zoning in the city of Pittsburgh in a lot of areas works against the ability to develop enough housing to meet the demand. I went to a very interesting talk last week. The gentleman, Nolan Gray, who spoke, talking about zoning and current requirements for minimum parking, things that bar the development of greater supply. And, you know, because, I mean, I know we're coming at from different angles, and I think that where we find overlap is a wonderful place. And I'm curious, you know, kind of where this would come on your end as well, but kind of coming from the market's perspective of this. You know, anytime you're looking at a raising of prices in a particular market, you're going to say, well, there's obviously demand rising here and the supply is just not meeting it. In a lot of ways, we need to look to build our supply in the city of Pittsburgh for housing. And a large issue with that is the difficulty to develop. It's obviously not as bad as I'm from Suffolk County, New York, and it's terrible, the zoning out that way. You know, especially considering the fact that, you know, so many people are leaving. You know, it's a much more drastic case of what's already happened in Allegheny County. You know, people are leaving because they can't find affordable housing. And a lot of that has to do with a lack of supply driving up the pricing. And we really need to, if we're going to take any serious steps towards trying to have a long-term plan for, you know, how do we address affordability, I would say, you know, we're looking to advise a new incoming, well, not incoming, but now a fresh administration at the county level. How do we address this issue? We should really start by looking at things that we can do at no cost to the taxpayer or to any negative impact on the economy, which comes in the form of zoning reform. And I think that that might be a wonderful place to kind of start if we're looking at ways for us to equitably deal with the issue of affordability.
I agree. I absolutely. I think that it's such an underrated part of local politics is zoning. I think everyone kind of thinks of it as rather boring, but it really is so crucial to every part of the process of urban development and planning. And I think, you know, in our city, like, on the one hand, yes, it's very hard to... there's also an issue of geography, right? Mm-hmm. Like, on top of that. I mean, I live down in a valley, right? And
yeah.
And not far from where that proposed development was. I don't know if you...
Is it the Mon Valley... not sure exactly.
It was a development that was proposed that was going to be, like, right in the middle of that chunk of Frick Park.
Vaguely.
Right,
vaguely
down
aware
forward.
Of it. I would have to look into it more, but even for the listeners who might not be aware, just a quick summary.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you're ever driving on Forward and you go down the Forward Hill down towards Swiss Home Park in Swissvale, you know, that whole winding road on the left side, you know, you'll see a Walnut Towers, and then below that, it's all Frick Park, right? And that area, this sort of chunk where the old Irish Center is, is zoned for parkland, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like at the moment, you can't build an apartment complex on it. And the intention was to build an apartment complex on it by a Toronto-based firm for luxury condos for, like, basically old people moving out of Squirrel Hill.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's constructed... I mean, the architecture for it was painful to look at. But, you know, that aside, you know, it was constructed in such a way that it proved to be more ecologically hazardous and also, like, physically hazardous for its residents.
Gotcha.
Than anything else. Because we have some roads in Pittsburgh and some places in Pittsburgh where it's damn near impossible to cross certain roads.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have access to public transit or if the road is, like, there's not even sidewalks on Forward.
Yeah.
Right? You know, how are you going to expect a bunch of old people from Squirrel Hill to kind of live in this, like,
uh-huh.
you know, mountainside monastery? They're never going to get out, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, like, when we're talking about things like zoning reform and development, it has to be done with a lot more discretion in a place like Pittsburgh than it does in somewhere like New York. Like, I'm from upstate, right?
Yeah.
Buffalo's flat, right? It's, like, if you've ever been to Buffalo, New York, it's just... as far as the eye can see, right?
You're just seeing nothing.
You can see Niagara Falls from, like, the top of a tall building, you know, like, no more than 40 feet, and you can see the smoke. You know, but if you're in the city of Pittsburgh, it's not like that at all, you know. You've got things that are as, you know, massive and steep as Mount Washington and Polish Hill, and then areas that are actual floodplains, like downtown. And so I think, like, I'm hoping that Sarah Namorado's new climate action plan that they're working on in the Office of Sustainability does include some serious criteria to look at, you know, how to rezone and put standards on development such that you're not actually putting the residents at risk, because, like, it's a dangerous place, like, in terms of climate and urban infrastructure here, because there's so little attention put into certain parts of the city. Mm-hmm. I think you'd agree, you know.
There are some areas that need a little TLC.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So that I think you and I are in perfect agreement on that. And I think, you know, if... I hope Sarah Namorado will listen to us at some point. You know, I'm sure she'd be happy to, but... yeah, if there is any change to be made, I think first and foremost, it should be one that holistically reinterprets how our zoning has worked in relation to the environment in the past, where it's been, you know, pretty much like any other American city, right? Like, you just draft these zoning lines to either promote different kinds of inequity or to help safeguard certain industries, and instead should be really more looking at how we can better serve the Allegheny County community as a whole, rather than just any particular industry or any particular community.
Yeah. I mean, we are in our last minute over here. Any kind of closing thoughts on the issue?
I really think that, you know, in the next few years, we have a great opportunity with this new administration to push for some very direct sustainability initiatives in terms of housing. As well as in terms of more general urban planning, like complete streets programs, which would help reduce a lot of that stress that those residents might face if you build somewhere like near Frick Park,
yeah,
where you have such strong inclines. So I'm looking forward to working with Sarah Namorado and others in Allegheny County on making that a reality for us.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely very interested to see where this goes. I mean, you know, we have areas where we might split a little bit, but I definitely think that we have a lot of agreement in the right places. And I'd like to really thank you for coming on today.
Thank you.
It's been a wonderful conversation. And thank you all for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful day, and God bless.
Hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, and welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today we have Dr. Etta Fields Black, who's a professor of history here at CMU and who just won the Pulitzer for her book Combi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, what you do here, and what other stuff I may not have mentioned yet?
Sure. So I am a professor in the Department of History, and I teach courses on Africa and the African diaspora, which includes the Middle Passage, pre-colonial courses on pre-colonial African history, modern African history, the Middle Passage, West African history through film. I also direct the Dietrich College Humanities Center.
So I asked you here to talk today because you did just win the Pulitzer Prize. Can you tell us a little about your book and about the Combahee River Raid?
Sure. So the book is about what happened on June 1st through 3rd, 1863. June 1st, about 9 p.m., Harriet Tubman and her group of spies, scouts, and pilots piloted Colonel James Montgomery, who was the commander of the raid, up the Combahee River in three armed U.S. gunboats. And aboard were the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, about 300 Black soldiers, and the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, one battery of white soldiers. They burned 7 rice plantations in 6 hours, and all the buildings, the stables, the plantation owners' homes, the barns that had the previous year's rice crop in it. They opened the floodgates in the rice fields and destroyed the rice crop that was currently growing there. They burned a bridge at Combahee Ferry, which would prevent the Confederate planters from trading rice, exporting it, as well as using it to feed Confederate citizens and the Confederate military. And they freed 756 people. And I argue in Combahee that this was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, largest and most successful, and second only to the Haitian Revolution in the history of the New World.
Wow. That's really cool. I also heard you found a family connection to that history.
I did. And a lot of people think that I assume that I wrote the book because my great-great-great-grandfather fought in the raid. And no.
No.
I actually learned this in the process of researching the book. I was looking for him and trying to find out more information about the Fields family at the time that I was starting the book. And so there are connections to the research, but I didn't set out to write a book about him and didn't really know the details. There's still more that we don't know, but I didn't know much besides his name and the name of his son, and father to son down to my great grandfather. I didn't know much about him before I started writing the book.
That makes sense because, from my understanding, this is a pretty hidden history, which is why it's so awesome that you're bringing it to light.
Thank you so much.
So, how did you do the research for this? Because I assume it's not as easy as, going down and flipping open other books and learning all about it.
No, it's not. So I was really surprised that so little had been written about the raid, and so little had been written about Harriet Tubman's Civil War service. And I think in large part that's because it's not her service, her leadership is not recorded in the official military record, which to me is not surprising. And what it meant is that I had to look in other places. So I started, and where I found much of the information about Tubman that, historians didn't know before, came from the letters of abolitionists. Abolitionists with whom Tubman had been in community before the Civil War broke out, after she liberated herself, when she became part of abolitionist networks in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and upstate New York. And so in the letters of some abolitionists who came down to Beaufort, Port Royal in the Sea Islands after a big battle in Beaufort called the Battle of Port Royal in November of 1861, I was able to find them writing letters home about Harriet Tubman and what she was doing. And it was often not the abolitionists themselves, but their children. So William Lloyd Garrison's son, for example, and Frederick Douglass's son, both of whom joined the military. Garrison was in the 55th Massachusetts. Douglass was in the 54th Massachusetts. Both of them were stationed in the area. They encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about her. So these were young people who grew up with Tubman, and they volunteered after this Battle of Port Royal to come down as the freedom seekers were adjusting to freedom. And they encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about them. For the freedom seekers, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the Cumbie River Raid through the people who were impacted by it, particularly the enslaved people who were liberated in it. And I found those sources at the National Archives, the U.S. Civil War pension files. So I'm using their testimony in the pension files to tell their side of the story.
Do the pension files have what they have to say about things as opposed to what the other people would have to say then?
They are very underused. And in the files, people testify about the raid. They also testify about their families. They testify about community life, courting and weddings and childbirth, going to church, and people who were not going to church and had gotten put out of the church for all kinds of modern behavior, like living with people with whom they were not married. So they talk about, real life, and they talk about it in a way that historians had not seen. You don't see this in the historical literature of slavery, right? To hear people who were born and raised in bondage tell their own stories. And when I say raised, people who, were not free until they were adults. So they spent much of their lives in bondage. We had not heard their stories. And so it is a very, the pension files, U.S. Civil War pension files, are definitely an underutilized resource.
So, in terms of Combi, you were focusing on telling the story through the eyes of enslaved people. And I know you've also worked on other stuff like Requiem for Rice, which is like symphonic. So how does this working in interdisciplinary and multimedia works affect the way you kind of tell history?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have worked with both artists and scientists, and worked with a scientist really to find interdisciplinary sources to tell the stories of people who didn't leave written documents. So in the case of peasant rice farmers in pre-colonial West Africa, right, using archaeology and soil science and biological and botanical studies of mangroves in order to find out how peasant rice farmers developed their mangrove rice technology. And then I work with artists to translate this research into broader audiences, really, and to translate it into artistic mediums, which will appeal to broader audiences, more people than would ever read my books, my previous books, at least.
yeah, I hope a lot of people are reading this one.
Come be selling like hotcakes, but that's another story. to really bring this research to life, you know, and to find a way to communicate it so that people can really empathize with enslaved people and see them as humans and see them as, I say, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, you know, aunties, uncles, cousins, sweethearts, and baby mamas, to see them as just everyday people, you know, which I don't think is a way that we have been able to see enslaved people in the past.
Would you say that you work even in your books in terms of trying to bring it to a broader audience, or are they more of an academic thing and then you spread them out through your symphonic works or your librettes or stuff?
Yeah. So my previous two books were written for academic audiences. Cumbie is written for a general audience and published by a trade press. And so what I found is that working with the scientists and working with the artists, and sometimes I would be in the rice fields with both the scientists and the artists, and that was more fun than one should be allowed to have, that's transformed the way I write history, you know, and it's transformed the audience for which I want to write history. So it's no longer just an audience of academics. Right. I want to write for academics and I want my work to be well, highly regarded by academics. But I also want to write for the general public. I want the general public to feel like they are a part of this history, too.
Yeah. And it's a heavy history. Is there any way that you deal with going through all of that and writing about it? Because that seems intense.
Yeah, it was quite intense. There are a lot of emotions that come up in reading these documents, you know, primary source documents from the time, which are detailing what enslaved people endured. And my goal was always, first of all, to experience the emotions myself, and then to try to translate them, to try to channel them in a way that, to try to channel them into the writing, right? Into the narrative, so that your average reader could experience what I experienced, what I felt, and could hopefully then empathize with enslaved people, could think about them, as I said, as people, you know, whose families were being torn apart, whose health and bodies were constantly being put in jeopardy and exploited, you know, to create a commercial rice industry, which was incredibly lucrative to the planters and the slaveholders, but which came at a great cost for the enslaved laborers.
I think you focus on the rice industry, which I think is interesting, because when I think of, you know, what they were teaching me in high school about enslavement, they were mostly talking about cotton plantations. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little more about how rice played into that system?
So rice is another little told story. We know that the foundations of the rice technology that was used to create the commercial rice industry in coastal South Carolina and Georgia came from West Africa. So it was brought here by enslaved people who were from the Rice Coast region, which is Senegal in the north, down to Liberia. We know that growing rice for commercial purposes with enslaved labor totally transformed this technology. And it created a very deadly environment for enslaved people because rice is grown in water. And standing water breeds mosquitoes. And those mosquitoes carried malaria, right? Malaria was endemic to the region. So people who were enslaved on these plantations, their health was completely compromised. They suffered from chronic malaria, which didn't kill them, but shattered their immune systems to the point where children were born, babies were born, and many failed to thrive and died before their first birthday. And two-thirds of children who survived the first year didn't survive past their 15th year. And then even as adults with, you know, years and years and years suffering from chronic malaria, couldn't fight off things like respiratory illness, right? So people are dying from other disease, other illnesses. They're not dying from malaria, but because of chronic malaria, their immune systems can't fight these other illnesses. Just a very deadly environment with the highest death rate, second highest in the New World, only to sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So it's something that a lot of Americans, we don't know about because cotton is sort of king in the U.S. South, but rice is also extremely, extremely important.
Are there any other untold stories that you like to focus on?
Well, I'm looking for the next one. I'm giving Cumbie its due. But I am also thinking about my next project and sort of laying the groundwork for the next project. So I want to continue telling untold stories. I want to continue giving voice to people who have heretofore been voiceless and exploring and finding new sources with which to tell their stories.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Do you have any ideas of what comes next, or is that still in the works?
Well, there is an art exhibit based on Cumbie that opens May 23rd. So there are no breaks here, down in Charleston at the Gibbs Museum of Art. And it's called Picturing Freedom, Harriet Tubman in the Cumbie River Raid. I'm also in the very early stages of working with colleagues at CMU in information systems to create a portal through which we're going to crowdsource the transcriptions of a couple thousand U.S. Civil War pension files. And these files are this data set. Then we're going to use AI so that historians, genealogists, and family members can find out more information about individual enslaved people.
So in terms of AI, are there like new tools that you've been using lately that are coming out? Or are you still going through archives in an old library?
Well, both. I mean, I'm exploring AI with my colleagues so that I can just go through more. I transcribed with a team of research assistants, transcribed about 200 pension files, more than 200 pension files for Cumbie. And now we're looking at thousands, right? And so I want other people to really be able to access the pension files and to be able to access the information that's in them so that we can rewrite the histories of slavery and the Civil War.
In terms of working with your colleagues, I know you work in the Department of History, and you also are the director of the Humanities Center. How does that play into your work?
Well, I think that, you know, directing the Humanities Center, we are supporting faculty and graduate student research, original research, interdisciplinary collaborative research. And all of this is what I do, having collaborated with scientists, artists, and now, you know, the AI folks. And really supporting faculty in doing their amazing research, maybe doing more public-facing research if that's what they want to do, and just helping kind of break through the barriers that faculty run into in doing research in the humanities and making our work more visible. So in many ways, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do things like I have done, very ambitious projects, which in my case are very public facing. And yeah, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do more of that kind of work.
So in terms of your projects, you said Cumby is selling like hotcakes, but is there anything that you worked on earlier in your career that you think people should pay a little more attention to?
Well, in my book, Deep Roots, I'm using, I'm also telling untold stories and looking for new sources with which to tell them. So in that book, I'm using linguistic evidence and combining it with scientific evidence from particularly the botanical and biological studies of mangroves and different kinds of mangroves. I think it's a very interesting book. It's written for an academic audience, but it's all about endangered languages and recording endangered languages and using these endangered languages as a tool to tell the stories and reconstruct the history of people in coastal Guinea, West Africa, who also didn't leave written sources, and about whom many written sources by missionaries and slave traders and other kinds of traders were not really written. So really trying to fill that gap in the historical literature.
That's really cool. So in terms of the historical literature, it seems like a lot of it is written more by, as you said, missionaries or slave traders. Mm-hmm. Or like the stories that get written down are usually those of the people in power, maybe oppressing other people. How do you work with that when you're trying to tell your untold stories?
Well, some historians would disagree with me, but I don't throw those people in power out. What I do is I interrogate them as what I call hostile witnesses. And I try to, you know, fully acknowledging their biases, and try to find what is of historical value in their accounts. I also try to balance them. I don't rely on them completely, as historians have done in the past. So I try to balance them with other voices, particularly the voices of the people that I'm writing about, right? So in this case, the voices of enslaved people, I want to hear them tell their stories. And they often don't tell them in written form. In the case of the Cumby River Raid, they're testifying orally for these pension applications. But sometimes their evidence is in the land, right? And so this is what I did with my first book, which is Deep Roots, is to try to understand how these peasant farmers who didn't leave written sources, how they changed the land, right? How they changed the landscape. We can use the fruits of their labor, if you will, as a historical source. We can use the rice fields they built as historical sources.
I think that's so interesting to use a rice field as a historical source.
I use a rice field for everything.
How did you first start studying rice?
Well, I was interested, and this goes back to my first year in college. I was interested in the Gullah Geechee, who are African Americans and descendants of slaves from coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And they live on the sea islands. They live in the mainland, meaning the cities and towns. But they also live on the rice plantations, which are right on the interior of the coast. I was very curious about this language and culture because my father was born about 2 miles, 1 or 2 miles from where the raid took place. He's the last of his siblings born in the South Carolina Lowcountry before my grandparents migrated their family to Florida. First, they went to the capital city, which is not the capital, but the city, which is Charleston. And then they went down to Miami, Florida, where I was born and where my dad grew up. So I was curious about the dialect that my grandparents spoke because it was different than anything else I heard anywhere else, except when we went to visit my great-grandmother in coastal South Carolina. So that sparked my curiosity. And then, and I did a lot of reading about it as an undergraduate. And when I went to graduate school, was very interested in the Gullah Geechee and their West African connections. So how did West African languages and cultures influence what we call today the Gullah Geechee? And I chose rice as sort of the prism through which to look at that question. So that's how I got into studying rice, and I went to West Africa to begin my career, and then decided to write my second project on the other side of the Atlantic in the rice fields of coastal South Carolina and Georgia.
It's really cool that rice takes you all the way from West Africa to here to the Combahee River, right?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we're starting to go a little low on time. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I could say that, you know, Combahee is the first time that Harriet Tubman's Civil War service has been documented. And so that's a very important part now of her legacy and an important impact of the book. And Combahee also is introducing the U.S. Civil War pension files as a third source that historians can use to hear the voices and tell the stories of enslaved people in their own words and formerly enslaved people. And it's the U.S. Civil War pension files are also a source that genealogists and family members can use. Millions of African Americans can use to identify our enslaved ancestors and to learn our family history and to pass it down to future generations.
Thank you so much. This has been Dr. Etta Fields Black on Forbes Avenue.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA at WRCT.
Bye. started issuing his executive orders, I saw universities start scrubbing their language without being asked. I saw universities start